Listen again to the last verse from the Genesis account read from the lectern. The words of Jacob to Esau. For truly to see your face is like seeing the face of God. With such favor have you received me. Now listen to an echo of this face of God concept just read in a New Testament passage, 1 John chapter 3, verse 2. It does not yet appear what we shall be, but we know that when he appears, we shall be like him, for we shall see him as he is. Those are the text. My first reaction to Jacob's compliment to Esau, to see your face is like seeing the face of God, is to regard it as flattery, a buttering up device to avert Esau's much deserved wrath. After all, Jacob, hallowed though he is in our thinking, was not above craft, deceit, and guile on a couple of previous occasions. You remember, don't you, how he tricked his father out of the blessing intended for brother Esau, then later, how he outsmarted Uncle Laban in animal breeding techniques. But I suppose that in biblical interpretation, too, we should put the best construction on everything, and that includes Jacob's compliment. Besides, there is the solid fact in the verses before our Old Testament text that Esau had already forgiven Jacob and had graciously refused his costly conciliatory gifts. So that Jacob's compliment of Esau is true, regardless whether Jacob sincerely meant it or not. My second reaction to the compliment is a feeling of satisfaction. Satisfaction that Esau finally got the credit, long overdue. From childhood on, I've always felt sorry for Jacob's hirsute elder brother. Oh, I know, he was pretty foolish about his birthright. He didn't appear to be too bright. Lowest quartile, no doubt. But no matter how you interpret the scriptural account, there seems to be no doubt that in some respects, Esau got a raw deal. He had reason to be angry. And he shows mercy. Incomprehensible mercy toward Jacob. Now is Esau's moment of glory, of triumph. Of him it is said, in no less a record than Holy Writ itself, that his face is like the face of God. Justice prevails at last, and all's right with God's world once again. My third reaction is like unto the second, a feeling of satisfaction, but satisfaction for a different reason, the thrill of identifying with Esau. Take Esau as he is usually pictured to us, stripped of the sympathy with which I clothed him a moment ago. Let's call him stereotype Esau, you know, the hairy biped, cloddish and uncouth, a Philistine, if we may apply the term to him, before its time, one given to throwing his weight around and settling matters with threats and fisticuffs. If Jacob can look at that face and see in it resemblances to the divine countenance, then perhaps I can look at you, or that you can look at me. And we can see in each other's face the face of God. If it's true of Esau, then maybe, just maybe, it's true of us. Oh, blessed truth. The particular aspect of divinity that Jacob saw reflected in Esau's face was mercy. There's more to divinity, of course, than mercy, but nevertheless, God is nothing if not love. at most fearing death from Esau, and at the very least fearing violence or reprisal, Jacob is met with tears, embraces, forgiveness, all of which foreshadowed the even greater forgiveness God extended to us centuries later through the sacrifice of his son Jesus on a Roman cross. And it is that trait, the trait of mercy, that we long to see in one another in our everyday associations in this seminary community. When I see mercy in you, and you see mercy in me, then indeed to see each other's face is like seeing the face of God. Each of us becomes the cross in miniature, Calvary reenacted. But it is more than a trait that we see when we look at one another's face. We do indeed behold the face of God, more literally than we realize. For our body is his temple. God himself dwells in us. As C.S. Lewis has observed, next to the Blessed Sacrament itself, our neighbor is the most sacred object confronting our senses. For he too, in some mysterious way, hosts God. In, with, and under our Christian brother and sister, God is really present. Jacob's compliment to see your face is like seeing the face of God, it turns out, is not hyperbole, metaphor, poetry, or fancy. It is fact, literal fact. Comes a voice from the rear. What? You mean that that face over there in the 10th row back on the left side, that face ashen with hangover, eyes gleaming with lust, eyebrows raised in conceit, and lips curled in cynicism, that face is like the face of God? Come now. Of course there's a sense in which it's not true, or at least not true enough. Sin is ever with us, taking its daily toll, furrowing our brow, ruining our complexion, so to speak, destroying in us the capacity to reflect in our features the countenance of God. We know that. And it hurts us. Oh, how it hurts us. Nevertheless, God is pleased in Christ to consider our face his face. He chooses to see his beauty in our ugliness. That's what grace is all about. And that's one of the reasons we look forward to heaven. No gracious pretense there anymore, but glorious facthood. Facehood that is facthood. As our New Testament text promises, we know that when he appears, we shall be like him, for we shall see him as he is. You and I are going to see God as he really is, and in the process, really become as he is. In heaven, it's for real. There we can say and look at one another and say, without fear of exaggeration, to see your face is like seeing the face of God. How it works, I'm not sure. The causal word for in our New Testament text, if it is causal, has never been satisfactorily explained to me. We shall be like him, for we shall see him as he is. The word for seems to imply a vision of God that seems to do more than turn us on. Rather, it turns us, changes us, transforms us. In the process of beholding, the beholder, it appears, becomes like the beheld. But the divine chemistry is not explained. It is merely promised. How it works, we don't know. That it works, we can be sure. A beatific vision indeed.